dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Greetings and God bless. Welcome to another episode of Pass the Mic, Dynamic Voices for a Diverse Church, powered by The Witness, a Black Christian collective. I'm your host, Tyler Burns. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at BurnsClan. Please follow at your own risk. And joining me, as always, is the founder of The Witness. He has a very extensive bio. What are you doing? What's going on right now?
I love
you
New okay? York. I need New York. You know I love you.
Okay,
New
are
York.
You doing our alliterates?
Oh, are we on?
Doing, are you doing articulation
Here
drills
we go.
Right
yeah,
now?
Is this what you're doing? Are we recording?
Anyways, he has a very extensive bio. He is the man, the myth, the legend, the two-time best-selling author, the book award winner, Mr. Blue Check Verified himself, Dr. Jamar Tisby. What's going on, brother?
You caught me in the middle of my, you know, warm-ups. But yeah, you know, people it's
can see
good.
You know you can, we can see you, right? You know people can see you, right?
Well, that's great. That's great. Hopefully they're tuning in on YouTube and they're subscribed to our channel and they're catching our beautiful faces as well as our voices every episode.
Also, they can subscribe on patreon.com/passthemic. Just FYI, support the show. Even $1 per episode goes a long way. But anyway, brother, you haven't pubbed your Substack yet in a minute.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I just do a little bit of writing at jamartisby.substack.com. It's called Footnotes. Wonderful content, exposés. We drop stories. We reveal explosive news items of interest on a national scale, but you know, that's
I feel
not
like you're overselling it, but that's fine.
Oh, really? Oh.
you gotta pub it though. You gotta pub it. So this is important. JamarTisby.substack.com. Very important. Okay, Jamar, I was thinking about this. Do you have something in your family that people said for years that you later found out wasn't true?
No, my parents always were very forthright.
They're not
with
listening,
me.
Jamar. They're not listening. It's okay. You can be honest.
I would say it was more along the lines of stuff they didn't say.
Okay.
That led me to assume things. So like my parents came up in it, just to get real heavy about it and deep about it. My parents came up in a generation where as Black people to get ahead, you kept your head down.
Right.
Because you, for the first time, their generation had access to places like my dad was in middle management at a pharmaceutical company, had a cubicle and a computer. My mom was a teacher and she got a master's degree, right? These were new things for a lot of Black people. And the way they were able to make an entrance into the middle class, so to speak, was not to make a big deal about race, not to make a big deal sure, about difference. Sure. So they didn't talk about it nearly as much as they had wisdom, knowledge, and experience and could have. And so that, I think, led me to believe that it was less of an issue than it really was, mm-hmm. race. And so, yeah, it was through hard experience in high school around like police following me and my group of friends, getting to college where Black American students are like 3% of the undergraduate student body and being the only Black guy on my floor in the dorm. That's when my eyes were opened to some different realities and I had a lot of catching up to do. So I was like, oh, well, it worked out for my parents by doing it a particular way. But, you know, I've got to learn these things and maneuver a little bit differently for my generation.
Yeah, I was thinking about this more in a comical context because I think my parents did something similar with me. But when I started to talk about race, they kind of corrected that. Okay. They were like, no, racism does exist. You know, I know your school is saying it doesn't exist. No, it does exist. It's just not everything. But I was thinking about it more in a comical context because there's this music producer called Mike Will Made It.
Yeah.
So
Mike Will Made It.
Allegedly, he's like my second cousin or something. It's not true. But like, I'm just saying, like, literally, I was like,
why would you bring that up? Because I got excited for a second.
But this is what I'm saying, though. That's the myth. I got excited, too. I'm like, can I get concert tickets? Can you like shout me out on a song? Shout out Pensacola. Shout out A50. Do something. But apparently, I was having a conversation with a relative and she says, oh, yeah, Mike was at the Super Bowl. Your cousin Mike was at the Super Bowl. I was like, my cousin Mike. I was like, yeah, Mike Will. I was like, Mike Will made it? Mike Will? Like, that Mike Will's like, yeah, he's a Williams. Like, so like he's like one of us on your so-and-so side, on this side. I was like, yo, like I remember I put something out. I was like, yo, Mike Will, my cousin, yo, shout out to you. And I was like, it's not slowly but surely, when Mike didn't respond, I was like, I don't think that's the
Wait,
same
you
Mike
put this out like publicly on social media or something?
Yeah, I did, because I was thinking like, yo, this, I could take this to the bank. This was years ago, bro. This was like at the advent of Facebook. I'm thinking this brother is going to respond and be like, what's up, T? Yeah, what? Man, I remember playing basketball with you back in the day at the family reunion and all this. And then you find out later, like, Mike, it's like a totally different Mike. And
whoa.
Like, yeah, he's incarcerated and all that. Like, so I was just like, oh, okay, like, I've completely mixed up the mics here. Like, that's just.
You didn't pass the mic. You mixed
up. I mixed up the mics. Exactly. But it's one of those things where you run with the myth because it's so easy to run with things that sound good.
Let me tell you one more now that you said that.
Please.
Before you transition. My wife, my own wife,
See,
created
you're about
a myth.
To get in trouble.
Okay. When we were dating, she said T.D. Jakes was her cousin. For months, she maintained this flat out lie.
Wait, hold on.
She was just, bruh.
I need to know how this works out. Because we love Janae here. So you gotta tell me, how did this work itself out?
It ain't no taking up for her. This was just a flat out lie. We were talking one day. I brought up T.D. Jakes, and she was like, you know, that's my cousin. And we're new. We're just getting to know each other. I'm like, oh, word, for real? That's amazing.
Was that like a positive thing for you? Or you were like,
I was excited.
You gonna preach the gospel to me? This is pre woke Tisby. This is pre woke Tisby. This is pre black Tisby.
Oh my goodness. I was just excited because he's like a celebrity. I'm like,
okay,
oh my
yeah,
gosh.
True.
You T.D. Jakes. And so this went on. I said for months, it might have been for years, because I never suspected to check on it, right? Like to verify its truth. And finally, I had brought it up again one day. We're married at this point. And she's like, what are you talking about? You didn't know I was kidding? You didn't know you didn't know I was lying. Like, it wasn't just a joke in the moment. She let this sucker persist. She let me labor under the delusion that she was cousins.
I mean, he's everybody's cousin to an extent.
Uh-huh. Know? Yeah, no. Don't no. She's I hold
that's
it
hilarious, bro.
As a remarkable wrong perpetrated against an innocent party. So you were introduced it by that way. I'm just giving you an example.
That's hilarious because I think everybody has something in their family or in their group of friends. I love how stories evolve over time, right? So something happens with a group of friends and then all of a sudden the story is far more extensive and embellished than what it actually is. And so every time you tell the story, you add something new to it, right? I remember in college, we used to always sit around and tell stories. And when you tell stories, you'd be like, it didn't really happen like that. But at that point, you're like, you have to embellish. It has to get bigger and bigger. And I'll tell you, some of the people who are known for causing this to persist are preachers. Mm. Preachers tell a story once and you keep listening to that same preacher tell that same story. And then it was five people that were standing off against them when they were preaching the gospel. Then next time it's 10 people. Then the next time it's the whole city. The next time it was the entire
world.
Yeah, it's me and the whole college dorm and me and the whole, they put me out in front of everybody. And so it's funny and humorous in that context, but I think it's also honest. We have to be honest and admit it's a myth. Like, and myths feel really comfortable. And it's funny when it's our family. It's funny when it's a relation. It's funny when we're talking about things that are lighthearted.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets serious when we're talking about myths in history.
Mm.
And there was this recent story that came out in the Washington Post, and it blew my mind. It took over social media, and it's a bombshell. And so the title of the article, written by Jillian Bracco, title of the article is MLK's famous criticism of Malcolm X was, quote, a fraud, the author finds. So Jonathan, I believe his name is Ike, was deep in the Duke University, this is a quote, deep in the Duke University archives researching his new biography of Martin Luther King Jr. when he made an alarming discovery. King's harshest and most famous criticism of Malcolm X, in which he accused his fellow civil rights leader of fiery demagogic oratory, appears to have been fabricated, end quote. Jamar, so did you hear about this? As a historian, how did this make you feel? And this is funny. This is funny on two different notes because it applies to you because I call you Roots. And this is literally about the guy who wrote Roots. So I feel like this is like, it's like Inception, bro. It's just like PTM Inception.
Just an alley-oop right there. As a historian, boiling mad. This does more than almost anything to undermine faith and confidence in the discipline of history. Now, it's important to note Alex Haley's not a historian. He studies history, but that's not his primary vocation or training, right? But still, Roots is viewed as a work of history, and indeed it does contain historical elements like that. He's viewed as somebody who's an authority in terms of a voice and a perspective on history. So it still has a similar effect of undermining confidence in historical studies.
Let's read a couple of more excerpts from this particular article, because I think this is crucial to understand what's really happening. So, and I quote, the quote came from a January 1965 Playboy interview with author Alex Haley, a then 43-year-old black journalist, and was the longest published interview King ever did. Because of the severity of King's criticism, it has been repeated countless times, cast as a dividing line between King and Malcolm X. The new revelation shows that King was much more open-minded about Malcolm than we tended to portray him, Ike said. Now, another quote says, Haley's legacy has been tarnished by accusations of plagiarism and historical inaccuracy in his most famous book, Roots. But this latest finding could open up more of his work to criticism, especially the autobiography of Malcolm X, as told to Alex Haley, released 9 months after Malcolm X's assassination in 1965. End quote. So this is important because we need to read what actually was said. Okay, so on page 60, this is again another quote. On page 60 of the 84-page document, Haley asks, and I quote, Dr. King, would you care to comment about the articulate former black Muslim Malcolm X? End quote. King responds, quote, I have met Malcolm X, but circumstances didn't enable me to talk with him for more than a minute. I totally disagree with many of his political and philosophical views as I understand them. He is very articulate, as you say. I don't want to seem to sound as if I feel so self-righteous or absolutist that I think I have the only truth, the only way. Maybe he does have some of the answer. But I know that I have so often felt that I wish that he would talk less of violence, because I don't think that violence can solve our problem. And in his litany of expressing the despair of the Negro without offering a positive creative approach, I think that he falls into a rut sometimes. End quote. Now, that's criticism, but doesn't sound like what actually appeared in the interview, which was, and I quote, this is what the interview contains, the published interview, quote, and in his litany of articulating the despair of the Negro without offering any positive creative alternative, I feel that Malcolm has done himself and our people a great disservice. Fiery, demagogic oratory in the black ghettos, urging Negroes to arm themselves and prepare to engage in violence as he has done, can reap nothing but grief. End quote.
Dang.
What?
That is beyond light editing.
Beyond liberty. This is beyond.
Whoa.
Like, you're just literally rearranging and taking small portions and just rearranging everything and adding things that
completely
wasn't even included.
Embellishing it.
This is massive.
It is massive.
Because for most of us, the assumption that we have is that Malcolm and Martin represent these two opposing sides of black thought and black freedom and black activism and the approach to how we get free as people. And so we cast them as polar opposites. And not only do we cast them as polar opposites, or we cast them as kind of maybe extreme avatars of their points of view, but also so do scholars and theologians. I remember James Cone wrote a book about between Martin and Malcolm. Mm. This whole idea of positing, how do we parse through these two different ideas? I feel in between a little bit of Martin, a little bit of Malcolm.
Absolutely.
This is major, man. And it shapes debate, thought. Think about the decades of these conversations and the decades of people who dismiss one or the other based upon comments like these.
Okay.
Let's go. This is the Roots episode. So you got
to
go.
Philosophically, we tend to think in binaries, right? It's Malcolm or Martin. It's nonviolence or violence, right? So just as human beings, I think we can easily fall into these easy dichotomies between one or the other, which is just not how the world works, right? The other aspect that we overlook is the ways that white people use Malcolm and Martin.
Yes.
And have set them up as polar opposites and dichotomous figures in order to pacify the masses, right? Well, you don't want to be like Malcolm X, the demagogue. You want to be more like Martin Luther King, who said he wants his kids to be judged by the color, not by the color of their skin, but the content of their character, right? So it has been used purposefully and intentionally as a tool to divide and pacify more radical black thought and traditions. But the other part is, even within, we're talking about these two individuals setting them up against each other, sort of as a binary kind of thing. But even just taking one of them at a time and looking at their lives and their public work,
yes,
there was change.
Yes.
So when people refer to Malcolm X's fiery rhetoric about violence, the ballot or the bullet, right? His thinking and his method evolved.
Yes.
And even King's criticism at the time of he's not proposing a constructive alternative. Well, then, you know, Malcolm X goes on the hush. He comes back. He is much more broad-minded in terms of who can participate in changing unjust systems. He forms the AAU as this sort of Pan-African uplift organization. So even within their own lifetimes, and Martin Luther King Jr. similarly undergoes different transitions in his public work. So not only do we have this myth-making between two figures, there's myths within just one single individual in the way we look at their lives.
Let's take a break because we got to come back and I want to hear some more of these myths in history. But I also want to ask this question. When we point out and find myths in our history, in our family, in our community, in our churches, what do we do with them?
Mm. Hey, folks, this is Dr. Jamar Tisby. It has been so much fun recording Past the Mic for 10 years. Can you believe it? And we're still going strong. That's because of you. If you are not already a Patreon supporter, I'm inviting you to help us continue this podcast for as little as $1 an episode. Just go to patreon.com/passthemic. That's patreon.com/passthemic and help us continue this journey with you. So Tyler, you said I could nerd out a little bit.
Let's do it.
On this. So I want to bring up two other examples around myths that get inflated and that we believe. So we've been talking about Martin Luther King versus quote unquote, because I don't think we should be pitting them against each other. Martin Luther King Jr. versus Malcolm X, right? And what Malcolm X represented to many people was Black Power.
Yes.
Before the phrase really took off, which was in June of 1966 in Greenwood, Mississippi, when Stokely Carmichael got up on the back of a truck and said, what we want now is Black Power, right? So then Martin Luther King Jr. is pitted against Black Power and people like Stokely Carmichael along with Malcolm X. And he's seen as, the myth is that Martin Luther King Jr. is like completely opposed to Black Power. But what he says in his final book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community?
Yes.
He says about that phrase, Black Power, he didn't think the phrase was going to be effective. But in terms of the principles, he was on board. So he said this: we must use every constructive means to amass economic and political power. This is the kind of legitimate power we need. We must work to build racial pride and refute the notion that black is evil and ugly. But this must come through a program, not merely through a slogan.
Hmm.
So what I'm trying to say here is Martin Luther King Jr. was much less opposed to the principles right. of Black Power as a movement than people tend to recognize. It's a myth that he was completely against it. What he was thinking about is winning people to a cause. He was thinking about the utility of that phrase, Black Power, and those kinds of things. But as far as like the notion or the concept of Black Power, oh yeah, MLK was on board with
that.
Of
course.
In all kinds of ways.
Makes sense.
So that's one myth that we got to break. Here's another one, which is along the lines of what you brought up around this fabricated quote. Well, there was another apparently fabricated quote, this time attributed to Carolyn Bryant, Emmett Till's accuser, the white woman who accused Emmett Till of, well, it depends. Here's the issue, right? What did Till actually do? Something happened in that store, but the story got inflated over the years to where Till all but raped this woman, essentially, in the myth-making, right? Well, there's this book that came out by an actual historian, Timothy Tyson, called The Blood of Emmett Till. Came out in 2017, was a New York Times bestseller. What made it such a bombshell was he interviewed Carolyn Bryant for this book and got this quote from her that says that she made up the most salacious parts of her interaction with Emmett Till. So the way Tyson explained it in his book was he went to interview her. He was asking her about the fateful day and her testimony in court that he had touched her hand, put his arm around her waist, all these things. And she said in his book, he writes that she said, that part's not true. That part where he did all of these things, touched me, threatened me, all of those things, she said, that part's not true. Maybe he committed some minor indiscretion in Jim Crow era at the time, but the part that really got her husband and brother-in-law upset that led to his lynching, she said, that part's not true. Now, here's where we run into the rub. So there's an investigative journalist whose work is very well respected. His name's Jerry Mitchell. He has gone back and researched all these unsolved cases of lynchings or racist brutality in Mississippi. And he comes out and says that there's no proof that Carolyn Bryant ever recanted, ever said that part's not true. So he went to Timothy Tyson. He's like, where's the documentation? Where's the recording? Where's the notes in your notebook when you talked to her? And then he said, when I reached her daughter-in-law, Marsha Bryant, so this is Carolyn Bryant's daughter-in-law, she said Tyson had interviewed her mother-in-law for the purpose of helping her edit and publish her own memoir, More Than a Wolf Whistle, The Story of Carolyn Bryant Dunham. And then Tyson called Bryant's claim that he was editor of the book BS. And then she said, Bryant, this daughter-in-law, told me that she had been present during the entire time that Tyson spoke with Dunham. And this is Carolyn Bryant Dunham. She remarried. And that she had never heard the words that Tyson quoted.
Wow.
They weren't in the tape transcripts either.
And we ran with that.
We ran with
it. Like she recanted.
Yeah.
This is massive. One more quote from the article in the Washington Post that we were reading from earlier. Ike says this, what Haley appears to have done amounts to journalistic malpractice.
Yes.
So this is not just a myth that comes from, that appears in a story or is mentioned in passing or someone says in recanting oral history or telling oral history. We're talking about something that shapes debate and shapes
Absolutely.
Conversation.
Yes.
And more than what we want to admit, I believe myths shape so much of how we live our lives. Mm. What we believe about ourselves, our families, our communities, our churches, our country, and it also shapes the way we find meaning in the world. And it's my theory that myths can keep us, if we allow them, and if we do not recognize them for what they are, can keep us from truth. We've been talking about this ongoing response that many conservative Christian colleges have to racial justice? And what about racial justice is offensive if you acknowledge the myth that we have not done things well? The idea that America's quote unquote Christian nation, the idea that America has no flaw, the idea that God has uniquely laid hands on America and covered America from sea to shining sea. Well, that myth must be protected at all costs. And if we sacrifice a few truth tellers to preserve the myth, it reminds me, and this is, you know, fictional, right? But it reminds me of that moment when T'Challa confronts T'Chaka in Black Panther. He's like, why didn't you bring the boy home? Like, what's going on? Why didn't you? We had to preserve. We had to hold on to the lie. Because, from cultural reference to cultural reference, as Slim Charles would say in The Wire, if it's a lie, we stand on that lie. We fight on that lie. And I think so many of us are preserving certain things. So what do we do when we find out something is a myth? We recognize it, or maybe we've known it all along. How do we remove it our thinking? Because that seems to be the hardest part.
I like where you went with it, with the myth of this nation, right? Being a Christian nation, being on this ever ascending climb to righteousness, right? That is a big part of what is afflicting our society right now, particularly our democracy and our churches, is the attempt to preserve this myth about our institutions, about our nation, about its founding, right? And so preliminary to your question in terms of what do we do about it is recognizing that there is a utility to these myths. They serve a function. What's happening is, whether we know it's a myth or not, we choose to perpetuate it because it's doing something for us, or we think it's doing something for us, right? So in these sort of nationalist myths, it's preserving a particular power structure and hierarchy. So even if it's not true, that's neither here nor there. The point is, we want to keep the status quo, or we want to extend our power. Or the point is, I don't want people to know the truth because then this, and this would happen, right? So I think in terms of responding to myths, we've got to recognize how a myth functions in terms of what people think it's preserving or what benefit people think they're getting from it.
Right.
And then I don't know any other way to confront myth other than with truth.
Well, and so this is where we get into a little bit of the complication, right? Because yes, myths persist. Often, as I was mentioning earlier, myths aren't necessarily all lie. They're sometimes merely the embellishment of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, no, this could be true. And I think in this case, we find an example here with Malcolm and Martin. Because it's true. Malcolm and Martin did see things differently, did have different perspectives. And so some people look at the quote and say, yeah, it's journalistic malpractice, but there's some truth in it. There's some truth in it. And so how do we dismantle the myth that contains a modicum of truth?
Right, right.
How do we dismantle that? And let me give an application here. Because I think for some people, I know we're talking about history and the country, but some people stay in institutions, in churches, because while much of what they heard and felt and saw, they found out later was myth, there was a lot of good in it. And there was some truth in it. And so we start to talk ourselves into a protection of the myth that has some truth. Oh, yeah, sure. Not all of it. It wasn't all good, but it wasn't all bad.
Hmm.
And so what do we do in these moments? And I don't think it's necessarily like some 3-point answer. I think it's something we're constantly wrestling with, which is, okay, what do I do with my Christian education?
Hmm.
Like, what do I do with the fact that, yeah, they were selling some wild stuff and it trained me to think and process and speak and live in a certain way that has helped me and that has sharpened me. And now I'm using some of those principles now. You know, but it's in a different context. I think that's just a constant wrestle, which is, yeah, a lot of this was fake, but it wasn't all fake, was it?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's always going to be that element because people are trying to convey truth. And so there's always going to be an admixture in a sense, right? If you have a body of thought, right? So there can be individual specific facts that you can verify or not. But the myth making comes in when you're combining lots of different points, lots of different stories, right? And so when you start to combine these things, then it does get much more complicated. You're trying to untangle the Christmas lights at this point, right?
Mm. That's good.
And I don't know. Maybe it's because as a researcher or whatever, there are no perfect figures. There are no perfect individuals, right? And your ideas, this is where what I think we need to do is cultivating an attitude and a posture of epistemic humility, as they say.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So the malpractice.
Break that down, epistemic humility.
Yeah.
Maybe I've not heard us say that.
Epistemology, the science of knowing, how do we know what we know, what's true, all of those kinds of things. And humility to say we can be corrected, we can have our ideas corrected or changed, right? And approaching any big question or important matter with the posture of I could be wrong, there could be myths that I'm believing, I am open to extending or evolving in my thinking here, epistemic humility, right? And I think that's the attitude that we need to approach any of our stories with, is that we hold them, but we hold them loosely.
Yeah.
They might be wrong. And here's where the malpractice, the journalistic malpractice comes in, is Haley didn't demonstrate epistemic humility in that moment. He didn't allow himself to say, you know what? Maybe Martin Luther King is not as opposed to Malcolm X as I thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying that and having an accurate quote, for whatever reason, he wanted to embellish it because that upheld the myth. Here's more of the utility of myths. It confirms our biases.
Yeah.
That's a function of myths.
It's so comfortable.
It's so comfortable. So, and then with same here with Tyson's book, it confirmed a bias.
We knew she made that up.
Right. We knew we probably.
So hearing that was the smoking gun. Yes. There it is. We proved ourselves right. And in the end, we play fast and loose with the truth. You know, I think you touched on it earlier, even in passing, but I feel like at the root of all of this, the root of our inability or hesitation to confront myths is fear.
Yeah.
And specifically the fear that there is not enough grace for the truth.
Ooh, speak on it.
And there is an idea that we have that if we tell the whole truth, and if we are truth tellers to the extent to follow where truth leads us, that what we will find will be too complicated for God's grace. And I think deep down, I think this is why we conceal. I think this is why we hold things back. Because we believe that on the other end of radical confession and on the other end of seeing things as they are in the right context is not grace, but judgment.
Mm.
And we don't believe God's grace is sufficient.
Mm.
We don't believe that God's grace is sufficient even for the ugly truth.
Wow.
And it may not necessarily apply to Malcolm and Martin, but in many areas of our churches, communities, lives, we have held back from telling the whole truth because it has been convenient, but also because there has been this innate fear that if I tell the whole truth and if I see the whole truth and if I promote the whole truth, what will happen to me?
Yeah.
What will happen to them? What will happen to us?
That's right.
And what will happen to us is we'll find out just how sufficient grace really is. And we'll find out just how real God's presence really is. And again, I think this is so applicable because this is why we don't have time for this. This is why we get in front of people and don't tell them the truth about race and justice.
Mm.
Like, it is not simply the fear of preservation. It is the fear that we will be guilty of condemning them. This is why people say, "Oh, you're condemning people. Look at you're weaponizing division."
Huh.
And I'm like, if God's grace is that amazing and sufficient, then no matter what you say about what I've believed, which I didn't personally do, which is the gag, right? You didn't personally do it. I'm not saying you were a slaveholder. I'm not saying you were a slave master. I'm not saying you wrote the policy. I'm not saying you said the slur. I'm saying this might be something that we need to confront accurately so that we don't replicate this pattern and continue to disenfranchise and marginalize people sinfully over the course of generations.
Wow. Yeah.
But literally in your heart, you don't understand that grace is that amazing.
Wow.
And you don't understand that there is that much in God. This is why we tell the truth. We tell the truth because we believe that on the other end of the truth is a beautiful freedom and revelation of who God is and who we are in Christ and who Christ has made us to be. And I just, there's just that, there's that, that understanding of that reality that I think we are just not confronting. And there's just this fear. And the fear now of going back and saying, well, what did I get wrong because I believed this? There's grace for that. I think there are some people even that may be listening that may say, I believe things that I'm looking back on now and I'm ashamed. And I was this. I love this, that moment when the young man, I don't know which one it was, but one of the representatives in Tennessee, they found this old clip of him talking in a different way and talking things in a different way. And they were like, it's some gotcha quote or some gotcha video. Look at what he was doing 10 years ago. And I'm like, dog, if you look at what I was doing 10 years ago, I mean, I don't even know if I'd be a pastor. Like, what in the world? Like, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, like what? Of course. But there's grace enough to change. And there's grace enough to grow. And there's grace enough to say, yeah, I believe that because it was comfortable. And I believe that because I trusted this person and they told me this and that. But now I can tell the truth about that. Now I can see what it really is. I think people need to hear that there's grace.
And people need to give grace too for that growth. So a lot of times when I kind of clench up sometimes in certain groups when I talk about my journey.
Here you go. You know, RTS, TGC,
exactly.
You know,
right. Because people are like, you dummy. Why did you expect any different? Why did you believe them? Why did you? I'm like, well, because they sold it well, you know, because they meant for you to believe it. And because I had these experiences and this relationship and XYZ, and I've learned and I've grown. Like, why? But it feels shameful, not just internally, but because of the way people react.
Yes.
Because they're not extending that grace for growth, right? And, you know, one of the things I always say about racists is like, I'm not going to spend a whole bunch of time trying to debate or persuade people who are just dead set on harmful ideas. But I say, I always leave the light on for you because there's room for growth.
It's here when you're ready.
It's here when you're ready. That's fine. You may have come from a certain spot, which is not healthy. It's not good.
But it's here when you're ready.
Yeah.
The truth, and this is the beautiful, and I think this maybe is the point in the end, but truth is always here for us. And the myth is comfortable, but the truth is what'll set us free. And it's always here.